From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we are live at the Democratic National Convention. Oh, wait, no, we're not, because it's pretty much all online due to the pandemic. Although, Robin, we are wearing these headset microphones, which we probably would be wearing if we were at the Democratic Convention.
And I'm wearing all sorts of buttons and things, you know, hats and buttons.
Well, it was supposed to bring all the party people and heavyweights to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but instead they are trading in that in-person pomp and circumstance for a virtual speaker schedule that starts tonight. NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow joins us now. And Scott, you're not in Milwaukee either. You're in Wilmington, Delaware, where Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are. That says a lot right there. What is this convention going to look like?
I'm in Wilmington, which is now the only place that I go, because it's just about the only place, with a few exceptions, that Joe Biden has campaigned since March. It's going to be just a big TV show. It's going to be all online. Biden and Harris will be speaking in Wilmington. Other speakers will be speaking from across the country. Bernie Sanders and Michelle Obama and former Ohio Governor John Kasich are the key speakers tonight. This is really kind of, just like so many other things in the world of the pandemic, a fast forward of a trend that was already underway for a while. The conventions have become more and more of just a TV show with an enormous cast of a full arena for a few decades now. And this kind of solidifies that fact, even though a lot of reporters and a lot of delegates would much rather be having a big party in Milwaukee right now.
Well, let's talk about one of the speakers you just mentioned, Bernie Sanders, who's going to be speaking tonight. Here he was on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos yesterday.
A lot of my supporters are not enthusiastic about Joe Biden. You know why? I ran against Joe Biden. But I think there is overwhelming understanding that Donald Trump must be defeated, Biden must be elected, and that the day after he is elected, we're going to do everything we can to create a government that works for all of us and not just the 1%.
Scott, Sanders is walking a fine line there. What is he going to be doing tonight? And is the party worried that his supporters may not turn out for Biden?
I think there's always going to be that worry. I think a lot of Democrats feel a little more comfortable knowing how hard Bernie Sanders has worked for Joe Biden and to get his supporters as excited as they're going to be about Joe Biden over the last few months. It's certainly way more than Bernie Sanders did for Hillary Clinton. One big thing that Sanders keeps pointing to, and I expect he'll point to tonight, is the fact that Biden's campaign and Sanders' campaign worked really hard together to come up with essentially almost the entire Democratic platform with a big task force that did a lot of work over the spring and moved Biden a little bit to the left on a lot of issues. Certainly nobody is going to mistake Joe Biden for Bernie Sanders, but Sanders feels like he can make the case that Joe Biden is advocating big picture for a lot of things that Bernie Sanders wants to see done.
Another speaker tonight is going to be the Republican former governor of Ohio, John Kasich. Here is what he said on Morning Edition today.
The party doesn't have to be your master. You can feel free to cross the aisle and vote for somebody else. That's not some terrible thing to do. In fact, if you see somebody you like and you respect, it's what being an American is all about.
Scott, does Kasich have the kind of influence that I guess Democrats would hope he would in order to convince Republicans tonight to think about abandoning President Trump?
No, I don't think huge chunks of Republicans are going to change their mind based on something that John Kasich says at the Democratic convention. I think this is actually one area where a virtual convention is probably better for the programmers than an in-person convention. I have a hard time seeing the crowd of hyperpartisans cheering wildly for John Kasich if he had spoken in the arena in Milwaukee. But look, to point out again something that's really important, Donald Trump won by the smallest margin in just a handful of states. And if just a few Republicans in states like Pennsylvania and Michigan change their minds or were leaning for voting Biden and feel like Kasich gives them validation to, that could make a big difference.
Now, Kasich is actually going to have more airtime than Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is only being given 60 seconds to speak. What about that? And are progressives going to be unhappy about what they see at the convention?
Yeah, that's certainly frustrated some progressives, and that's certainly creating a lot of online conversation this morning. I think the thing to remember is that it's only a two-hour program, and Michelle Obama and Bernie Sanders are certainly going to be getting a lot of speaking time each. So I think every single speaker is going to be pretty short, but certainly, yeah, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who we should point out did a lot of work with the Biden campaign on its climate change policy, will not be getting a starring role today.
That is NPR's Scott Detrow ahead of tonight's kickoff of the Democratic National Convention. Scott, thanks.
Thanks, Jeremy. Talk soon.
Lawmakers were supposed to be off during the convention, but Democratic Speaker Nancy Pelosi is calling the House back into session later this week to vote next Saturday on a bill that would stop any changes to the Postal Service. In Pelosi's announcement yesterday, she accused President Trump of a campaign to sabotage the election by manipulating the Postal Service to disenfranchise voters. Let's bring in NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis. And, of course, Sue, President Trump would characterize it in a different way. But Speaker Pelosi says this vote comes in response to changes pushed by Louis DeJoy, the Postmaster General. Remind us what those changes are.
Well, there has been changes to the rules in which your mail actually gets delivered, the changes to the transportation routes they have to take, and essentially trying to eliminate overtime as cost-cutting measures. And there's also been some efforts on the removal or transfer of mail sorting machines. The cumulative effect of those is mail delays are being reported all across the country. And Democrats see it as a possibly politically motivated decision, considering that DeJoy is a Trump appointee and President Trump has a very well-documented and public case criticizing not just the post office, but mail-in balloting, because he thinks it does, it believes it will make it harder for him to win re-election.
And remind us more about just who DeJoy is and what he says about this. He says this is cost cutting and trimming.
Right. He's a former business executive. He was appointed Postmaster General in June. He's also a major Trump campaign donor. And this is a job that traditionally isn't as, you know, politically motivated as a lot of other appointments. Now, it's not unusual at all for donors to a president to get positions inside their administration. But I think it's happening at a completely or at a very politically loaded time, at a time especially when people are concerned about the security of the election and when we're going to likely see unprecedented numbers of mail-in balloting. At the same time, the post office has been in financial straits for a long time. And DeJoy has defended some of these actions in a memo to employees in which he said he acknowledged there had been unintended consequences, but said that tough decisions have to be made about how the postal system is run. You know, counter to that, the postal system is not necessarily a business and shouldn't be seen in the same way that you would see profit margins for the public sector. It's a critical service. And I think the fact that Congress is coming back is also in part a response that there has been a big outcry in the country because people are dependent on the post office for lots of services, not just how they're going to vote this November.
Well, and the House is coming back to vote on the Delivering for America Act. What would that bill do?
It's a pretty simple piece of legislation. It would essentially bind the post office under former policies. It says if something wasn't in place on January 1st of this year, it cannot be changed until January 1st of next year, essentially undoing those changes that DeJoy made and making it impossible to implement any others. They're expected to vote on it this Saturday over the weekend. Generally speaking, you know, Congress tries to stay out of the way during the political conventions and let the nominees drive the news cycle. But Pelosi was under immense pressure to bring lawmakers back. You were hearing it not just from Capitol Hill, but from Democratic corners all over the party. There was one moderate Democrat, Jim Cooper, who is not exactly known as a fire thrower in Congress. And he said publicly he thought that the speaker should arrest the Postmaster General if he does not agree to come testify before Congress next week. And I think it's just a reflection of the fact that members are pretty hot about this. And they feel not just the pressure from their constituents, but also a real concern that if changes aren't made, there could be additional problems with how the vote is cast and counted.
Well, does this bill have a chance of passing both House and Senate? And if not, you mentioned perhaps DeJoy coming to testify. What other ways might Congress hold him accountable?
Right. Well, they have requested both he and a member of the Board of Governors to come and testify before the House Oversight Committee next week, next Monday, I believe. So, you know, I think that's one way they're trying to keep pressure on the administration. It's not entirely clear he's going to show up and testify on Capitol Hill. The administration has been known to sort of block appointees that they don't want to face Congress from going up and testifying, oftentimes citing the pandemic or that their jobs are too busy to do it. So one thing we're watching for is if he does in fact come up or not. It will obviously be a very high profile hearing. in terms of the legislation itself, it's a little bit more complicated. You know, when the House Democrats tend to push forward something, it doesn't usually mean the Senate Republicans are going to race to take it up. But in this case, I do want to be clear, there are a lot of Republicans who share these concerns. One, you know, mail-in voting, despite the president's attacks on it, historically has been good to Republican candidates, and there's not the sort of concern about winning and losing elections there. If anything, there's a lot of concern among Republicans that their voters might be afraid to cast mail-in ballots, and they're trying to sort of change that narrative. I also think a lot of Republicans represent more rural places in the country, and rural Americans, more than many others, rely on the post office for things like getting their prescription drugs delivered or getting their government benefits delivered. So there's bipartisan support to get something done. They want to look responsive to this. So it's I'm not going to say nothing's going to happen, but it's unclear yet what happens next.
Well, and Speaker Pelosi is asking representatives to show up at their post offices tomorrow. Yeah. See what happens there. NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Robert Zoellick has had quite the career so far. He was president of the World Bank. He served in a number of presidential administrations, and he's a senior fellow at Harvard University's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. Now he has a new book out called America in the World, A History of U.S. Diplomacy and Foreign Policy. And in it, he defines five traditions that have shaped our diplomacy: the continent of North America, trade, transnationalism, and technology, alliances and order, public and congressional support, and America's purpose. Robert Zoellick joins us on Skype. And which of those five traditions do you think is the most important for American diplomacy?
Well, I think they all have to come together. You know, you can't do it without public support. I think that in the end of the day, America does exist not only for what we do at home, but also trying to shape the global environment. That's the purpose in the world. You can't do it unless you've got a strong North American base. And what's interesting is many foreign policy people ignore that. They kind of just assume our relations are with Europe and Asia. But having a strong continental base will be important in our role in the world. Trade and economic relations is fundamental to partnerships and private sector role. And alliances is the story of the past 70 years. So I really feel that they have to be fit together.
In reading this book, you look back at people like Ben Franklin, the country's first diplomat, Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson, Monroe, Wilson. How much do you think that their ideals, and let's just talk about the founding fathers, how much do their ideals still shape American diplomacy and foreign policy today?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because insofar as people talk about America's history in the world, they tend to focus only on the post-World War II period or that's afterwards. There's a lot of interesting ideas and experience from the first 150 years. So when I look at each of these individuals, each one I try to associate with a perspective. So for Hamilton, it's the role of economic statecraft. Mm-hmm. With Franklin, it's a wonderful story, if you think about it, about moving from war to peace, the challenge of working with allies in Congress. So one of the points of this book is I try to go beyond the intellectual frameworks that are often debated and talk about the practical work of diplomacy. And I try to add my insights from my experience or how I read events based on that. And I think many of those experiences from those earlier periods still offer guidance today.
Well, let's talk about some events today. What do you make of diplomacy in the Trump administration? Because whether it is China or Iran or North Korea, we've talked to experts who say he doesn't have a strategy, that he's making it up as he goes along. He often says when he's asked about bad behavior of an adversary that we've done bad things too. There were the meetings with Kim Jong-un that haven't yielded what was promised, his meeting with Putin in Helsinki, in which he didn't confront him about election interference. He's insulted allies. What do you make of it? What do you make of his diplomatic strategy and diplomatic record?
Trump's style, as you see in his presidency in general, is very transactional. So therefore, it doesn't focus much on building economic arrangements or alliances or long-term institutions for America's influence. It's very personal. It's narcissistic, and other players, including authoritarian ones, are able to play into that. In many ways, I think it's a reflection of his domestic political base. So if you think about it, you know, the wall with Mexico, his anti-immigration policy, that's a core signal to his supporters. And certainly on trade, he's really the first protectionist president we've had since Herbert Hoover. And that's a signal to his political base. I suppose the other quality is that he wants to be very different from his predecessors. He's kind of the anti-historical president. So whether it's the Bushes or whether it's Obama, he has to be different. So I think that's one reason why the book might be, while historical, offer some insights for where we go from here, because in some ways, Trump has been the disruptor.
Well, on the issue of trade, do you think that tariffs can be a good lever for diplomacy? He's not the first president to use them.
Yeah, it depends if your goal is to lower tariffs or not. But, you know, Trump in his inaugural said he was a protectionist. That's a pretty good hint. And on top of that, he said he's a tariff man. So if you take, say, the relationship with China, after 3.5 years, he finally negotiated sort of a purchasing package agreement. And really, they're only about halfway to sort of the targets they set. He didn't change the rules. He didn't try to open the markets more effectively. And the tariffs are still in place. But equally so, you know, claiming that Canada is a national security threat to raise aluminum tariffs, this just raises costs for Americans and frankly hurts our exporters, farmers, others, and hurts our role in the world.
What would you advise on the issue of China? Because no matter who wins the election here in November, the president is going to have to figure out what the U.S. relationship with China is going to be. It's the most populous country on earth, and soon it will be the richest.
When President Xi took office in 2012, he created a documentary film about the end of the Soviet Union, and he ordered all the party cadres to see it. Now, if such a film were shown in Europe, Gorbachev would be the hero that helped end the Cold War. Well, the Chinese version is fundamentally different. Gorbachev is the fool who abandoned the Communist Party, led to ruin in his country, and the not-so-subtle message is it's not going to happen here. The Cold War, which is a historical event for most Americans, casts a very long shadow in China, and it's important to understand that. Having said that, I think I would start by working closely with my allies, which Trump has not done. In the past months, we've had this verbal attack that I think has led to quite a serious freefall or quite danger in that sort of relationship. And I would go back to the pragmatism that I talked about in the book, which is what do you want to accomplish here? If you take intellectual property rights, which are discussed, China's created intellectual property rights courts. They're actually giving a lot of awards to foreign companies now, but the penalties aren't high enough. In the case of Hong Kong, if we want to send a serious message, well, maybe we should allow people from Hong Kong to come to the U.S. That would show the difference between the two systems. So In a complex relationship like China, you're better off if you're working with our allies and, frankly, people within China who see the need for change. I think the administration's policy is largely based on their political desire to have an enemy in the election.
America's purpose is one of the traditions you talked about. There's always been this idea of American exceptionalism, of America as a shining city on a hill, a beacon of hope for the world. Do you think that that still exists today? And, you know, there are a lot of things going on and there are a lot of, you know, news events that have happened that would make people question that. But just look at the coronavirus right now. We've got, you know, 50,000 plus cases a day in the United States and, you know, a few hundred in a lot of the European countries. We don't seem to be a shining city on the hill when it comes to how we've handled the coronavirus.
Well, Jeremy, I distinguish a little bit between exceptionalism and purpose. But I do think that whether it was a case of a founding republic, whether it was preserving the union, whether it was Wilson's idea about making the world safe for democracy, or the role that we played as the leader for the free world in the Cold War, that is part of kind of the American spirit. Now, your point is an excellent one, which has to start at home. The basic model that we send to the world is not necessarily what we tell others. It's how we represent ourselves. And that's not been a good story recently. However, what I often tell people abroad is, you know, you can't just look at the White House. America is a society of people and organizations, you know, so it's the Gates Foundation working on coronavirus, second biggest funder in the WHO. It's even the Federal Reserve, which has done an amazing job with the swaps program in the process of the global financial crisis or now. It's the SpaceX for this summer, as well as other things. So I believe there's a resiliency in America. And the question is how our leadership and how our people sort of reshape that for challenges such as biological security, inclusive economic growth, environmental and energy security, data security, but also opportunities. I believe it's possible, but that's one of the things that America's debating.
You were in the George W. Bush administration. How do you look back on diplomacy with regards to the Iraq war? Because many would say we didn't exhaust all the diplomatic options before going in and didn't have a true coalition.
To give you the context, I was the U.S. Trade Representative during that time. So I was working on the trade and economic issues and creating free trade agreements. But I think the context I would say is, number one, I think historians will look back on 9/11 and recognize that of the anxiety it created for President Bush 43 and those around him. Second, I don't believe President Bush would have gone to war except for his belief that Iraq did have nuclear weapons. That leads to, I think, a third important issue, which is your role of intelligence agencies. And this will be much debated, but I personally think it's very important to have your intelligence agencies be independent and willing to be straight and be the unpopular person in the room. Because clearly there was a mistake there. Some would argue it was pushed from the administration on the intelligence agencies. But I think that's what led to what became a very long and difficult and tragic war and conflict. And then there's the question, which I also deal with through the book, is that, you know, it's one thing to fight a war. It's another thing to try to reach peace. Going back to my story with Ben Franklin.
That is Robert Zoellick, former president of the World Bank, has held a number of government positions during a number of administrations, and he's the author of the new book, America in the World, A History of U.S. Diplomacy and Foreign Policy. Robert Zoellick, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Jeremy. Enjoyed it.
And you can find an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org. An extreme heat wave is continuing to smother parts of California and the Southwest. Temperatures in Death Valley hit 130 degrees yesterday. That's the hottest temperature recorded on Earth since 1913. The triple-digit heat is prompting rolling blackouts in parts of California again today and making it harder for firefighters to fight wildfires in several parts of the state. For more, let's bring in Lily Jamali, co-host of the California Report at member station KQED in San Francisco. Lily, we heard reports of fire tornadoes over the weekend in Northern California. Let's start with the fires. What's the latest on where they are and how big they are today?
Yeah, well, there was a series of fire tornadoes actually that hit forest land near the California-Nevada border where firefighters are battling what's called the Loyalton Fire. So that's one. That's one of the biggest, which burned almost 30,000 acres so far in the Tahoe National Forest, and it's just 5% contained, according to state fire officials. Down south, there's the Lake Hughes Fire burning in the Angeles National Forest. That one has burned almost 20,000 acres, and it's been going for about 5 days now. So firefighters are definitely, working on it, but have had some trouble getting a handle on that one. Both of those fires have forced evacuations. The same is true for another blaze that ignited just yesterday in Monterey County near Salinas. That one has burned 2,000 acres, so it's not quite as large for now. Four firefighters, though, suffered heat-related injuries while battling it, and a handful of structures have burned. So many more structures threatened, and we are keeping our eyes on all the blazes that are going throughout the state right now.
And what about the blackouts? Californians have been using a lot of energy to cool down. The power companies have actually been cutting power. These are the first rolling blackouts in California since the 2001 Enron crisis. What's going on there? How many people are losing power?
Yeah, it's a grim milestone to be sure. We had blackouts on Friday and Saturday evenings. They affected in PG&E's territory, which is the largest utility out here. 200 plus thousand people were affected alone. And the way this works is because it was so hot, as you say, people were using a lot of power, presumably to try to stay cool. They're running their air conditioners. Here in California, there's a nonprofit called the California ISO that operates most of the grid here. And they saw that demand for power was getting dangerously close to the amount that power plants were able to produce. So with that supply and demand problem, that entity directed the utilities to start shutting off power to parts of their systems to make sure that there wasn't a much bigger system-wide failure like what you all experienced out on the East Coast in 2003. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to just be clear that these outages are different from the preemptive power shutoffs that you might have heard about from last fire season. That's where the utilities decide to shut down the power so their equipment doesn't spark a fire. In this case, the utilities were being told to shut down sections in order to relieve some of the pressure on the grid.
Meanwhile, we mentioned 130 degrees in Death Valley. I saw a photo of two people standing there taking a picture. I couldn't believe that they could be standing outside with 130 degree heat. But just very quickly, how long is this heat wave going to last?
We're expecting it to last through much of this week. Everyone is bracing for tonight because we've had those outages on Friday and Saturday. We got a reprieve yesterday. And it's rainy, it's drizzly off and on in certain parts, which is really unusual, but really the key is to conserve energy right now.
Until recently, much of the information we've had about where enslaved people were captured before being brought to America came from shipping logs and databases like Slave Voyages, which details everything from ports of embarkation to the numbers of men, women, and children transported, a horribly dry calculation of a terrible commerce in humans. Well, now there's new information drawn from genetics that reveals to today's descendants of people enslaved in America that their ancestors had consequential stops before reaching this country and suffered unspeakable atrocities. The study called Genetic Consequences of the Transatlantic Slave Trade in the Americas appears in the American Journal of Human Genetics. It drew on genetic data from 50,000 23andMe users who agreed to lend their DNA. It's the brainchild of Joanna Mountain, a geneticist at 23andMe who'd been a Peace Corps volunteer in Kenya and developed a deep interest in what happened to people who'd been wrenched from that continent into slavery. She joined forces with population geneticist Stephen Micheletti on this new study. It's years in the making. Joanna Mountain, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
And we've got Stephen Micheletti as well, both of you in the San Francisco area in California. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. Great to be here.
Can you give us a broad brush headline? What did you find?
Yeah, so off the bat, as you mentioned, there's this vast database of records that details the voyages between Europe, Africa, and the Americas for about 1,400 years. And what we wanted to do was to work with historians and look at this database and then compare that to the genetic connections between people in Africa and people in the United States with African ancestry. Overall, what we found is that there are a lot of matches between genetics and the historical records, but also some discrepancies as well.
One of the biggest findings we had was a very strong bias towards African women contributing to the present-day gene pool as compared to African enslaved men, something that has been observed before. But what we found was that it really varies across different regions of the Americas, and it's known that even in the U.S. area, that more women had children than men. But when you get to parts of Central America, you see 13 to 17 times more women contributing to the current day gene pool than did African enslaved men. And so in discussing this extreme finding with historians and looking through the historical literature, we found indications that men were, you know, far less likely to reproduce, partly because they were at higher risk of dying early if they were, you know, having to participate in rice farming or sugarcane farming, which was very risky. At the same time, women were sometimes being forced to reproduce, And in some parts of Latin America, there would be initiatives to encourage European men to father children with African women in order to do something that they called dilute the African gene pool. Hmm. So there actually were policies that led to this bias and led it to it being more extreme in some areas than others.
It was just, I mean, horrendous. Women raped, forced to have children, again, before they even got to America.
Yes, and to see it in the DNA of people today is kind of shocking. I mean, this is something that we often think of as past, and yet the repercussions certainly continue to today in the DNA. It's kind of amazing that we see it so strongly in the genetic evidence.
That, to me, was the biggest takeaway. I mean, we know there was rape in slavery, but this sort of, as you said, trying to dilute a race, or there were far fewer numbers of women who were enslaved than men, and yet they had this huge contribution to the gene pool because they were so often raped. It's just a terrible takeaway. But Stephen, you said you were also surprised by the number of Americans with Nigerian ancestry. Tell us about that.
Like you mentioned, we see a lot of U.S.-based African-Americans with ancestry from Nigeria, and specifically connections to the ethno-linguistic groups, the Yoruba, San, and Igbo. And why this was so surprising is the transatlantic shipping records indicate that people around Nigeria weren't directly arriving in the U.S. in high numbers. But what we have to realize is that enslaved people were being forced between and within the Americas over centuries. So not all the movement was happening across the Atlantic. It was also happening between all these countries and within all these countries.
In other words, they were shipped to one place and then put on another ship and shipped somewhere else.
Yes, exactly.
Can you imagine surviving one shipping ordeal and then either you or your children getting shipped once again?
Or separated at that point.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, we understand another surprise for you was how few Gambian and Senegalese descendants of enslaved people there are in the U.S. Why? What's the reasoning there?
So we merged these two regions and call them Senegambia, and we didn't see a lot of Senegambian representation in the U.S. And again, that's another deviance from our expectation given the shipping records. And a working hypothesis is that Senegambians were typically Asian and African rice cultivators back in Africa, and the Europeans were well aware of this. So it's likely that Senegambians that arrived in the United States ended up on rice plantations because of their expertise. And what we know about rice plantations is that they were some of the most dangerous working conditions for enslaved people. One reason is malaria is a huge problem in these swampy rice fields, and there's also other risks like drowning.
So they died. They didn't have a chance to leave descendants. Again, terrible. You're working with real people. I know these were volunteers from 23andMe, over 50,000, that gave you permission to use this DNA. Have you had response from them?
So we definitely had quite a bit of response, and it's provoked some debate regarding enslavement and forced migrations, but also people seeing this story in their own lives. One individual said that whenever I'm in Jamaica and New Orleans, I feel a sense of connection. And for that individual, this study felt very real to him. And so that was super exciting for us.
Was he finding out that, in fact, your study showed that his ancestors came from Africa to Jamaica and then were shipped again?
So that is something when he read our paper, that's what came to his mind. And that would be an explanation for his sense of connection to those places. So that's someone reading the paper pretty closely. So we'd like to make it easier for people to get that sense of connection with the study.
And what have you heard, if you've heard at all, Stephen, from people who are discovering from your study what we sort of knew, but they're seeing it clearly, that there might also be some European DNA, that somebody who bore their ancestor was raped?
So one goal of this study was first to produce the data and then look at the historical records that best support those data. And unfortunately, the records that support those data are these horrible atrocities. And with that, we wanted to make readers aware of these atrocities because they've shaped the genetic landscape across the Americas. And we want people to be aware of the number of enslaved people that were impacted. And people are, I would say their eyes are opened by this study because a lot of people may have not heard about this history in the past. And I've received some personal messages that people are happy that we're looking into the history and not just providing a genetic study, but more of a collaborative study with historians and not ignoring all of these atrocities because it's part of their past. And people have discovered using services like ours that they have European ancestry, and now they have better context for why that is.
That's population geneticist Stephen Micheletti. We've also been speaking to 23andMe genetic researcher Joanna Mountain about their new study looking at the DNA of descendants of enslaved people and what it tells us about a devastating chapter in the America's history. Stephen, Joanna, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In an op-ed published yesterday in the Wall Street Journal, President Trump and Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Ben Carson vowed to protect the suburbs from what they call the, quote, chaos in Democrat-run cities. Suburban voters went for Trump in 2016, but polls show them favoring former Vice President Joe Biden this year. In an attempt to win them back, President Trump has stoked anxieties about crime and low-income housing that many have called racist. Derek Thompson is staff writer at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington, as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, President Trump has said he's going to win suburban housewives, which seems like an outdated term to begin with. But what is his pitch to people in the suburbs?
Trump's pitch to the suburbs is basically his pitch to every support group. There is an invading army at the gates, and only I can keep them out. So first, it was the Mexicans. He was going to build a wall. And then it was the Muslims. He proposed a complete and total shutdown on Muslim immigration. And now it's poor people. He's telling suburban residents that he's doing everything that he can to keep low-income, more diverse, and allegedly more dangerous people out of the suburbs. So in this op-ed that you just read from, he says, and I quote, "The Obama-Biden dystopian vision of building low-income housing units next to your suburban house," end quote. The dystopia he's talking about is living near people who earn less money than you. He's trying to spin it up as a nightmarish vision, but in many ways, I think that, as with previous attacks, even though he is physically in the year 2020, he is reconjuring fears of the 1970s.
Well, and many have called this pitch about the suburbs racist. But when we talk about the suburbs right now, politically and demographically, they are different than they used to be. The suburbs were 2/3 white as of the 2010 census, down from 81% the decade before. And since then, they've diversified even more. Tell us about how the suburbs are changing right now.
That's exactly right. These aren't the suburbs of the 1970s. If you sort of took a snapshot of the suburbs in, you know, the middle of the 20th century, you would say that this is basically where the majority of white people are living. And now they've become more diverse and they've become more democratic leaning. And you could argue that the first thing is causing the second thing, that as the suburbs have become more ethnically diverse, they've also moved considerably to the left. And you can look at the polling from the last 16 years. Bush in 2004 won the suburbs by 5 points. Trump in 2016 won the suburbs by only 2 points. And now in recent polling, he seems to be down an average of 15 points in the suburbs. So, you know, this is a demographic story that Trump is clearly responding to. He's afraid, and in this case, I absolutely agree with him, that if he does lose the American suburbs, he has no chance of winning the 2020 election.
And what about the idea that he puts forth in the Wall Street Journal op-ed that people are fleeing cities because of crime? Doesn't that ignore, first of all, trends that have been going on for many years, that people are fleeing cities because they've gotten more expensive? But now, because of the pandemic, a lot of people are fleeing cities because they can. They can work wherever they want. They don't have to be in the office in a city. Maybe they want more space for their family.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I think there's two points to say here. The first is that there are trends of people leaving dense downtown urban areas for the last few years, way before you had any semblance of a pandemic in the U.S. That's number one. You know, people have been moving to the suburbs of the Sun Belt for several years, if not several decades. The second thing that's really important to say, though, and Zillow just came out with a report that verifies this, Americans aren't quite fleeing cities yet. They are, yes, leaving San Francisco and New York, very expensive cities where you don't have a lot of affordable housing, but they're just moving to other cities, or at least to other metros. They're moving to Boise. They're moving to Austin. They're moving to Atlanta. And so this isn't so much a trend of the end of cities. It's really more like a trend where people are leaving expensive coastal areas and moving to the metros of the Sun Belt. But again, that goes right back to the first point. They were doing that in 2017, 18, 19, way before the pandemic. So, you know, this is a part, as with so much of COVID-19, an acceleration of pre-existing trends, not an invention of some new trend.
Based on what you've said about the polling, it doesn't sound like this pitch to win back suburban voters is working. Do you see that changing between now and Election Day?
I don't. I think Trump is trying to pitch this to a vision of the suburbs that no longer exists. He's criticizing an Obama-era rule that was basically all about verifying the 1968 Fair Housing Act and making sure that various suburbs were building enough housing for all income residents. You know, that was an Obama-era rule. It was an early goal of the Trump administration. And now Trump is referring to that goal as dystopian. But I have to say, if more housing for low-income minorities is your idea of dystopia, then frankly, I don't want any part of your utopia. We have to find a way to live together. And step one of that process is building enough housing for everybody.
That is Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now. Museums respond to the pandemic. We'll see how one is interactive exhibits like this one, asking visitors how should cell phone data be used for contact tracing.
Everyone should be required to participate in digital contact tracing.
I think we should be able to choose if we allow it or not.
Next time, Here and Now.